Blog Talk Radio.
To the oppressed. Dear friends, I greet you all at the People's Forum in New York City. Tahiyat Rasmiya. Hasal Ali to our Palestinian brothers and sisters there. As we reason and reflect on the plight of Palestine, let us not forget the recent passing of the late and beloved Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who is remembered today for his fierce critique of the oppression of Palestinians, which he compared to the generations of sufferers in his native South Africa under the bitter system known as apartheid. It is fitting here to recall the late Archbishop and to note the recent observations of the Francophone African scholar Achille Mbembe, who in his recent book, Necropolitics, published in 2019, sees some remarkable sights when he turns to Palestine. Mbembe writes, "Everywhere, the building of concrete walls and wire fences and other security barriers is in full swing. Alongside the walls, other security structures are emerging. Checkpoints, enclosures, watchtowers, trenches, all manner of demarcations that, in many cases, have no other function than to intensify the enclaving of entire communities without ever fully succeeding in keeping away those considered a threat. This is the case with all those Palestinian towns that are literally surrounded by areas under Israeli control." Mbembe, page 43. Professor Mbembe compares this system of repression with the apartheid system and finds something quite surprising, as he writes, "Such practices variously recall the reviled model of apartheid with its bantustans, vast reservoirs of cheap labor, its white zones, its multiple jurisdictions, and wanton violence. However, the metaphor of apartheid does not fully account for the specific character of the..."
My name is Daron Chavis.
Professor Mbembe. "This project," Mbembe explains, "is more complex, more intrusive, and emerges from deeper psychological and historical wells than that of the Calvinist project that crystallized in the 1940s to 1980s South Africa. Finally, the oppressed know something about repression, no matter where it happens. For love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu Jamal." Welcome.
So can you tell us what happened on May 13th?
Well, the first thing that people need to know about May 13th is that it did not happen because of any complaints from neighbors. I'm not saying neighbors may not have had complaints about us, but there's not one neighborhood in this country where some neighbors don't have complaints about other neighbors. What happened in May of 1985 happened because this government wanted to silence our unrelenting righteous protest over the ongoing imprisonment of our innocent family members. So what happened is people talk about May 13th, which was a Monday, but everything really started on Mother's Day, May 12th, Sunday, 1985. That's when the police began to amass out there on Osage Avenue and encouraged people to leave their homes, you know, told them that they should go out to dinner or whatever, and they could come back that evening after everything was over. And they set up high-powered equipment, weaponry, I mean, 50 caliber machine guns, M60 automatic rifles, sniper rifles with silencers, their 38 caliber weapons, all manner of weaponry of war. And when they felt like they had everything set up by the evening, by that night, then Police Commissioner Gregory Sambor came out and said, attention, move. This is America. You have to abide by the laws and rules of society, of American society, words to that effect. I'm still trying to figure out, I guess, what he meant by that. Because to say, attention, move, this is America, what's he talking about? Does he know what his children and grandchildren are taught that America was founded on? Resistance, you know, they're taught that this country was founded by people who went to war with cops called redcoats, with the government of England, King George at the time. I mean, what is he talking about? They defied legality and went to war for what they believed was right. And they're celebrated every year as heroes, as freedom fighters. What makes a Nathan Hale a freedom fighter and makes a Delbert Africa, a Leonard Peltier, you know, any other freedom fighter today, an urban terrorist? You know what? So this is what Police Commissioner Gregory Sambor said. I did not hear it at the time. I can't say for sure if anyone else heard them because they were killed. But we would not have come out had we heard him. I would not have come out had I heard him, because it was very clear he was not out there to arrest any MOVE person. He was out there to kill, to exterminate, eliminate. We could have been arrested at any time. We walked the streets by ourselves. We took our kids over to the park right across the street regularly. I mean, we walked from one MOVE house to another all the time. They had us under surveillance. They were always right around it. They could have arrested us at any time if that's all they were trying to do, but they weren't. Their aim was to kill. Wilson Good, then mayor, Wilson Good, first black mayor of Philadelphia, he said he wanted a permanent end to MOVE. That's what the words that came out of his mouth. And that's what May 13th was all about. After they made that announcement, after Gregory Sambor made that announcement, they didn't just try to wait us out or anything. I mean, what was the hurry? What made this so, you know, immediate? Were we accused of killing anybody, robbing, raping anybody, molesting children, pushing drugs on children? None of that. None of that. The charges against us were disorderly conduct, terroristic threats, stuff like that. I mean, no rape, robbery, murder, anything like that. So they set up their equipment, made their announcement, and when we did not come out, the first thing they did was use the fire department. Fire departments, firefighters are sworn to save lives, to protect lives. In May of 85, they used their equipment to attack lives. They turned those deluge hoses on our home, on us, for hours when there was no fire. After the water hoses were on us for hours, then the police department filled our home with tear gas. They filled it with tear gas. That did not bring us out. Then they opened fire on, first they blew holes in the party walls, like Osage Avenue has row houses all attached. they blew holes in the walls on each side of our house. Then they threw tear gas in, tons of tear gas. Then they opened fire. They shot over 10,000 rounds of bullets in on us within 90 minutes. That did not bring us out. There was a law. That's when they sent for the police helicopter. They did not have to send for the explosives, the C4 and the Tovex. They did not have to send for that. They already had it there. They concocted the bomb, two bombs, not one. They wanted a backup bomb. And they got in a helicopter, two members of the Philadelphia Police Bomb Squad and two state police, cops. Got in a helicopter, flew up over our home with no warning, no announcement or anything, and just flew over our home and dropped that bomb on the roof of our home. It ignited a fire. They were aware that it was a fire from the very beginning. They saw the smoke coming up. They were made aware of it. They made a conscious decision not to put the fire out. The fire commissioner, William Richmond, said himself that it was what you called an incipient fire, fire in the very beginning stages, and it could have been extinguished at that point with no trouble. They made a decision to let it burn. They let it burn out of control. When we realized our home was on fire, we immediately tried to get our children, our animals, ourselves out of that blazing inferno. We didn't know it was a fire at first. They did. And I cannot think of another example where firefighters know that there's a fire, know that there are men, women, babies, and animals inside the dwelling, and make a conscious decision to let it burn. That is unconscionable and makes it very clear that their intent was to kill, not to arrest. Anyway, we made several attempts to get out of that building. We were immediately met with a barrage of police gunfire, directly aimed, deliberately aimed at us to try to prevent anybody from escaping. The third or fourth time that, I attempted to come out, I was able to get out, although bullets were flying all around me. I was able to get a little boy, Birdie Africa, out, and he later described the bullets that were flying all around us. So it's not something I'm making up. We were both first taken to the hospital, then I was taken to the police station and charged with everything that they did. I went on trial. And what people need to understand, every single charge without fail listed in the warrants that they came out there with claiming to be attempting to arrest us on, they were all dismissed as invalid, having no foundation, meaning they had no valid reason to be out there. But they charged me with everything that they did, everything that happened after they came out there. Now, if they didn't have a valid reason for being out there, then everything coming from that was invalid. I mean, that's common sense. But they were not about to have me back out on the street, and they have to take responsibility for what they did, the murder of babies, So I went to trial. I was acquitted of most of the charges. The other charges, I was found guilty of riot and conspiracy. Now, how I rioted in my own house when we're surrounded by hundreds of cops armed for war trying to kill us, you know, how I conspired with my own family in our house. We didn't go to Wilson Good's house. We didn't go to any cop's house or firefighter's house. They came out to our house attacking us, you know. But I conspired. I was convicted and sentenced to 16 months to 7 years in jail. When my 16-month minimum was up, I was told by the parole board that they were willing to parole me, but only if I agreed to sever all ties with MOVE and had absolutely no contact with any MOVE member. They told my other sisters and brothers that same thing, who became eligible for parole. Not one of us would accept that. Not at all. It wasn't even a thought to accept that. So some of us did our maximum sentences. I did my whole 7 years. My sister Alberta and my brother Mo Africa did their full time, 7 years and 5 years respectively. My sister Sue Africa, one of our white members, did 12 years, her full 12-year sentence. We did our full sentences. Two of my family members, because we would not compromise, you know, and given, we kept the pressure on the parole board. They were forced pressure to parole two of our family members without that stipulation. And now the rest of the MOVE Nine, two of my family members have died in prison, two of the MOVE Nine, but the rest of them are still serving their sentences, even though they're like 7 years over their minimum, and the parole board keeps refusing to parole them, saying that they refuse to accept responsibility for the crimes of August 8th of 78. My family is saying, we did not commit any crimes, you know, and we're not going to lie and say we did. But the parole board keeps saying that they won't take responsibility for their crimes and they show no remorse. How are you supposed to show remorse for something you didn't do, you know? So that is our focal point right now, you know, focusing on getting them home, getting them out of prison. And we just went, me and my sister Alberta, just went to Geneva, Switzerland, to the UN to advocate for our family, to put out information. We weren't so concerned about meeting all of the delegates from the different countries because we have no faith in that process. We went there and we focused our energy on talking to the people. We talked to people from Kuwait, Pakistan, Morocco, South Africa, just all over. We spoke at two open forums. So we got to put out a lot of information and raise awareness about our family. This year marks 30 years since the bombing. And what we really want people to understand is that we were not bombed because neighbors complained about us. We were bombed. This government wants to annihilate MOVE, to silence our unrelenting protests for the release of our innocent family members. That's what people should really understand. We encourage people to come to Philadelphia and join us on May 13th of 1985. You can go to our website, www.onthemove.com, to get more information about it, to get our phone number, email address, so that you can contact us, you know, if people want to. We usually tell people, we have told people over the past 30 years, do something where you're at if you cannot get to Philadelphia. This year, we started back in October. We told people, come to Philadelphia. You have plenty of time between October and May to raise funds, do what you need to do to come to Philadelphia. We want Philadelphia to feel the heat from what they did in 85. We want Philadelphia officials to understand that people have not forgotten, people don't agree, and people will never forget what happened in May of 1985. It will mar the city of Philadelphia forever.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. So can you tell us what happened on May 15th?
Greetings. Welcome to a special edition of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. My name is Empress Chi. And you just heard, of course, Sister Ramona Africa. That was taken from an interview that was done at the 30-year anniversary commemoration of the MOVE bombing here in Philadelphia that took place on May 13, 1985. Now, of course, you heard Sister Ramona mention, of course, at that time, the MOVE members were still incarcerated. And, of course, since then, they have all been released finally after 40 years, it was. And, of course, three of them have made transition since that last interview. Sister Ramona is going to be doing an interview for us in the next couple of days due to health. We're going to do it with her, and then it'll be pre-recorded. We'll be bringing it to you unless we make other arrangements to do something earlier with her. So, you know, we did speak with, you know, some of the folk with her today, and we are working on a new interview, you know, that we would do within the next couple of days. But I wanted to share with you the facts. As you just heard Sister Ramona mention, she gave you the facts of what happened on May 13, 1985. For those of you who are not familiar with some of the very intricate details, you certainly got some there. It was something planned. It was just a matter of time as to what they would utilize to make their move. And so they utilized some complaints from neighbors, or what was said to be some complaints from neighbors. And again, we have to put things in context for you. What happened from May 13th, 1985 was a part of what happened on August 8th, 1978. It was all a part of it. And we start off with Mumia tonight because, again, it's linked to Mumia. And now that, of course, the MOVE 9 is released, all of them are released, we now are making certain that we put some focuses on Mumia Abu-Jamal. There is a hearing next month. Next month. I don't have the exact date with me right now, but I will have it for you tomorrow night for our regular radio broadcast. But finally, a new something is happening with Mumia. It has been a real struggle, needless to say, for him to be from death row and now in general population, and now hopefully soon to have him literally released. You know, again, that is, you know, what's being looked at. That is what the struggle is for now. After all these years of fighting all types of illnesses, hepatitis C, diabetes, you know, it's just been a continual thing now with a liver problem. And so the thing now is for Mumia to be released. And so, again, next month there is, in fact, you know, a hearing is coming up that will hopefully move things forward in terms of having him released. Okay. And so Again, family, we will keep you abreast on that. And again, tomorrow we will do part two of today's or this evening's session. Again, this is a special edition to at least begin to remember that 11 people died on this day, approximately, what is that, 37 years ago, I believe. Folks, not only in that neighborhood, we went out there today, as a matter of fact, to commemorate. We're waiting for Brother Mike Africa to call in. He might got a little delayed or whatever because, you know, he was part of organizing for today's activity. So we may have to wait to get him in for tomorrow because I know today was pretty hectic. But I did speak with him earlier, and he did say he would be calling in tonight. But, you know, a lot of times when you're doing an event all day, you know, you just need to just sit down and chill out. But at any rate, we will definitely be talking with him further. Again, you know, it's his father and mother who were a part of the Move 9, I'm sorry, the Move 11, not the Move 9, I must say, and of course they too are now freed. And it was, you know, very much a part of Mike, you know, staying involved, staying adamant to fight for his parents. And of course the ongoing work of the people for 40 years to fight for justice. And as you just heard what Sister Ramona said, you know, this system has a way of putting stuff on people that they actually did. And so we want to remind you again that now it is to really work closer in freeing Mumia Abu-Jamal. And speaking of freedom, of course, Brother Sundi Ada Akoli is now free as well after 47 years. And again, tomorrow night we will talk more about that, give you some updates on that as well. Okay, I do have a statement from Brother Mike Africa. I'm going to share that with you in the meantime. Again, hopefully we will be calling in, but if not, we understand because today was a pretty full day. I also spoke with Sister Pam Africa earlier. And, you know, this for some is like a day. Remembering this day is very painful, needless to say. And so for some, you know, it's just like almost overwhelming. But anyway, a statement from Brother Mike is, on this day, Philadelphia police dropped a military-grade bomb on members of the MOVE organization living at 6221 Osage Avenue. 11 black men, women, and children were murdered. As the police ordered the firefighters to let the fire burn and shoot MOVE members back into the home as they tried to escape. The violent attack came after over a decade of police violence and repression of MOVE, including the MOVE 9, who were political prisoners for 40 years, and, of course, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is still in prison almost 40 years. A black neighborhood was destroyed in the process. On the 37th year anniversary today, Osage Avenue, people convened at Osage Avenue and Cobbs Creek Parkway for a day of remembrance to honor the lives of MOVE victims lost in the horrific act of police terrorism and the destruction of a black community. Here in Philadelphia, 64 homes went up in flames. And, of course, people lost everything, all of what they had. And, again, that particular neighborhood, once you go in there, which, again, we're here today, it's such an eerie feeling there. You know, you can tell, you can feel something is not right. Well, certainly not right, but you know, again, there were young folks there, some who weren't even born when that happened. So for them to hear, for them to learn of the type of atrocity that took place there, you know, they were very surprised. They were shocked even to hear of what happened. Note, a bomb. Now, over the past year or so, people have talked about Tulsa with the bomb that was dropped in Tulsa 100 years ago. Well, can you imagine in so-called modern day 1985, even though it even was 37 years ago, it's still considered modern day. Can you imagine a bomb dropped in a black neighborhood? And guess what? Isn't it interesting that so many black folks today that were there at that time, and some are still around today. Isn't it ironic how that whole situation just kind of came and went? And for 37 years, a lot of, you know, people in Philly that were around at that time, you know, did and said very little. And you would think that after seeing something like that, after having 11 people being murdered, that that would have sparked them to continue to fight this system, to fight this government. Just like for some, the murder of George Floyd, it did what? It ignited something. It let people know that the type of terror and horror that's going on in this country cannot just be pushed to the side. And so, unfortunately, here in Philadelphia, for whatever reason, and some literally got shut down because, you know, they really are out this system, even though they try to talk about how they're not. Well, we can prove that, in fact, that is exactly what happened. And so one of the missions now for New Day and also for the Million Woman March is to begin to speak truth to power, but also to expose the kinds of not just hypocrisy, but the sellout behaviors that is in our communities all over the country. But since I'm here in Philadelphia and know the history of what's going on here, I'm definitely going to make sure that it is exposed here in Philadelphia. So at any rate, family, again, we want to make sure that people knew, had a better understanding of what happened here in Philadelphia in 1985 on this day, specifically May 13th. And how is that connected to what we are now bringing forward with the We Charge Genocide 21 Project? Well, you heard Sister Ramona Africa earlier. She said that she and Brother Carlos went to Geneva. They went to Geneva. They presented for the United Nations in terms of bringing this matter to that arena, to that kind of entity that deals with human rights issues. And so that now is what MWM is doing. Not just to bring forward the information about what happened here in Philadelphia in 1985, but what has happened all over the country to our people. So the We Charge Genocide 21 is 21 areas of crimes against humanity, and certainly in demonstrating and presenting what happened here in Philadelphia in 1985, it falls right into the scope of things all across the board. Because here's a prime example of an incendiary bomb being dropped in an urban environment. Now, the reason why we're playing that out is because that was not only illegal and unjust just based on the fundamentals, it was illegal based on the type of bomb that was dropped in an urban environment. Now, these are some of the things that many who are in law, and particularly those in Philadelphia, didn't bother to point out, at least not to the degree of really trying to do something about it or bring it into a fruition or a point that needed to be made. And so we're making certain that we do that, meaning that it was not only a crime to go into a black community, drop a bomb, and then say, let it burn. Now, note, I hope you all heard that very clearly. The fire commissioner was told by the police commissioner when the fire commissioner saw that the flame and things were getting all out of control based on the command level of how it operates, the fire commissioner had to go to the police commissioner to ask what to do. And in doing so, the police commissioner, his name was Saborn, told the fire commissioner to let the bunker burn. Let the fire burn. After being told that it was out of control and they need to do something, he was told to let it burn. So here's the point. That was not just illegal in terms of them dropping a bomb, or shall we say allowing it to burn, you know, being told to let it burn. It was also a breaking of a human rights violation, even in terms of the war concept. Because you're not supposed to use certain kinds of artillery or ammunition or whatever, except at a time of war. You see, these were points that were not brought out adequately in 1985 or subsequently thereafter. And we are making certain that we do, at least to put it on record. Now, for those who are haters and like to throw shade on certain stuff, and again, we're going to start identifying who some of them are as well, who say, well, you know, going to the United Nations, that ain't going to do nothing. As Sister Ramona said so eloquently, we have no faith in this government or certain forms of operations. That's not the point. But we do need to educate our people. We do need to connect with of our people. And so why not do that if you can? Because that is where the true power lies. That's where the true power is. And the more we educate our people, the more we are able to communicate facts and other types of in-depth portions of struggle, the more we are able to create a possible response that needs to be brought about. Now, again, for those who are not in the hood or not on those front lines, for real, they can very easily sit back and talk about what we should or should not do. But until you are walking in the streets amongst our people on a regular basis, folks need to shut the hell up. That's right. I said it, meant it, and here to represent it. So again, family, we want to remind you on May 13th, this day, 1985, 11 people were killed, 5 of them children. And by the way, you do know that a few months back, it was learned that some of the remains from 1985, some of the children's remains were in fact being utilized for research. It was learned last year that the University of Pennsylvania had in fact taken the remains of one of the children, of one of the actually newly released MOVE members. It was one of her children. And they took those remains and were using them for classes. It was 2 colleges, University of Pennsylvania and can't remember the other one right offhand. But this was just learned last year. And so to find that out after all of this other stuff going on, to find out that the remains, and note, it wasn't because that the universities were making the families aware of this. It was some research that was being done by some of the students initially, and in doing so, they came across that information. And then it began to, you know, people began to look further and closer and then found that the University of Pennsylvania had, in fact, had those remains since 1985, had not informed the family that they had the remains, and then were, in fact, using literally, and we're not just talking about ashes, we're talking about other parts of the body that were found or that was able to be extracted from the building. So yes, this again is one of the things we wanted to bring to folks' attention. This again is just clearly human rights violations right in your face today. So when you hear We Trust Genocide 21, yes, we talk about the issue of political prisoners. Yes, we talk about COINTELPRO. Yes, we talk about, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic, gentrification, mass incarceration, environmental racism, but also We're not just talking about the government. We're talking about institutions as well. The crimes against our people by not just government, but also by institutions and other entities. So again, we want to remind everyone that, you know, put this on your calendar. For those who observe European holidays, well, why not look at not so much as the holidays, but the days that our people, that are significant for our people. We ask you to take some time to maybe think about how we need to commemorate or at least make certain that we don't forget certain kinds of days and dates that have happened for us as a people. So listen, family, we're still waiting for Brother Mike to call in. I'm going to check to see what the status of that is. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, and we certainly welcome your comments, what do you think about what happened today? Or shall we say 37 years ago today? What are your thoughts about what you think could happen for the future? What would our people do if something like that were to happen today? What do you think the response would be? And even more so importantly, how prepared would we be to do anything? So if you have a comment or a thought, please press one now. I would love to hear what your thoughts are. In the meantime, let's hear a comment from someone else. This is a recorded comment, so we're just going to play a little clip from it.
We had on the radio on KYW, and we start hearing about the cops amassing.
With permission from the police, went down the street to the house and talked with Ramon Africa through the screen door. I just asked, is there any possibility that, you know, we might negotiate this thing out so that there's not, you know, a bad outcome here? She made it pretty clear that they were prepared to deal with whatever might come next or deal with the police, and that they were committed to a certain, they were taking a stand.
We figured they were going to try to do something. So we took ourselves and the children down to the basement, which is the safest part of the house, and was in accordance with our strategy for protection.
At 5:30 this morning, warrants were to be served on the MOVE members.
So we eventually took up a position in the rear of the 6200 block of Osage, nearest towards Cox Creek Parkway, and we heard the police commissioner make an announcement.
What did Commissioner Sambor say, do you know?
He was telling him to come out.
Could you hear him saying that? What did the Mona say?
Yeah. She was just arguing.
What we intended to do was to create a diversion on the roof of the MOVE compound. That diversion was to pour a large amount of water onto the bunker itself to obscure the vision of anyone that may be inside the bunker and prevent them from seeing the insertion teams as they made their way down Osage Avenue.
The water was just pouring down on us in the basement. And I mean, this was not for 10 minutes. Or half an hour. This was for a long time.
You started down the alley. You got down the alley approximately 15 to 20 feet and shooting started. And then we hit tear gas, which at that time wasn't supposed to be in the plane. So we had to stop and put our gas mask on. And like a lot of firing coming in front of us. I mean, it was shot and squeezed off. And it was rapid shooting. We couldn't move to the damn that alley and make that turn into the house because we had no clue where it was going. What we're going to do is we're going to go into the house next to MOVE. Members of the bomb squad would reach a hole into the basement and onto the second floor of 6223. The purpose was to breach a hole, put a pepper fogger through the wall, leaving the first floor for an avenue of escape for the MOVE.
What we wanted them to do was to come out of the front of 6221 Osage and surrender.
The police next door had a 50 caliber machine gun. People, when I called the office and I said, listen, they're using a 50 caliber machine gun, they said, you're crazy. I said, no, I'm not crazy. I have fired them, and I know what they sound like, and I also know that when it goes off, it shakes the floor in the house that I'm in.
At one time, as a result of an explosion in the back bedroom of the house that we were in, that was our explosion, we breached part of the wall. Also, Miller got the pepper frogger started. And I remember standing next to him when he pushed it through the wall, it had about a four-foot pipe. He got it up and he got it running, but he only got it so far in and hit something else. And the conclusion that we drew at that time, that they had walls inside the walls.
We have strategies to help protect us. You know, we know how these people come.
We realized that this was not what we anticipated.
They didn't blow 3-inch holes in the party wall. They blew off the whole front of our house.
And then we took a position in the front bedroom of 6223. Move would be on to our left as we were looking on the Osage.
Tear gas started coming in. We got the blankets and it was wet, and we had them in the bucket and it was wet, and then we put them over our heads and started laying down.
Well, there was a short lull, very short lull, and then that's when the shooting started. The cops on either side of us and in the back and across the street in front of us, because they just took over people's houses.
Well, while we were standing there and the pepper frogger was working, on the party wall was a result of automatic gunfire in a semicircle. That wall, on the other side of that wall, would be the move house. And there was a bunker above us also. At that time, under those conditions, we drew the conclusion that move was shooting through the walls at us. So we all took refuge, and we all fit almost into a closet. And I remember climbing, he didn't quite make it in. He was rubbing his leg. What happened is some of the rounds had hit the wooden floor. It was a hardwood floor, and the rounds flew up and hit him. Found that later on. But that time, under those conditions, we thought he was hit. That was the first time I really thought, other than going down the alley, I ain't going to get out of this closet. I really thought that was it for all of us.
According to police, they shot over 10,000 rounds of bullets at us within 90 minutes. Then there was a long lull where, you know, nothing was happening for a long time. And then that's when the cops sent for a state police helicopter.
Did you at some point conclude that the plan had failed?
I think at about 4:45 or 5 o'clock, I had reached a conclusion that we would probably have to wait overnight. That was at the point in time that Leo Brooks called me up.
Would you tell us what you heard the managing director tell the mayor?
To the best of my recollection, sir, and he told the mayor that we were recommending and that I had recommended that the best way to go was to use an explosive entry device to blow a hole in the roof so that we could insert gas in through the roof, and also to use this device to hopefully dislodge the bunker because it presented a danger to everyone, and that we intended to use a police helicopter, a state police helicopter.
And what did you think was the fate of the children in terms of blowing a hole in the roof?
My understanding was that it would work and it would therefore be safe for the children. I did not have any notion whatsoever that anyone on that site would do anything that would endanger the children.
Did you have any information or belief that there was any gasoline stored on the roof of 6221 Osage Avenue?
I don't recall. I've heard that several times since. I don't recall having been told prior to that there was gasoline stored on the roof.
All the men were upstairs.
All the men were upstairs. And then what happened?
They were still up there, and then they came down. Everybody came down.
All the men came down?
That's when the big bomb went off.
Did you hear the big bomb?
Shook the whole house up.
the house shake. We knew something had happened. It never, ever occurred to me that they had dropped a bomb on us. You know, we felt something, but I didn't know what it was. But, you know, in not too long a period of time, started getting hot and filling with more and more smoke. And we realized, we started hearing crackling of the fire, and the smoke was getting thicker and thicker. And we realized then that the house was on fire.
At 5 of 6 that evening, did you tell the fire commissioner to let the bunker burn?
I did not order the fire commissioner to do anything. I requested of him that if we let the roof burn to get the bunker, could we then, subsequent to that, control the fire? I wanted to get the bunker. I wanted to be able to somehow have tactical superiority without sacrificing any lives, if it were at all possible.
Sam Bohr said to me very, very briefly, if we let the bunker burn, can you still put out the fire? And the extent of fire at the time, is my only, the only thing I could judge it from my own experience was that, yes, I think we could. However, there was no way to be really sure, because if it had already breached the roof, we had a spread that we couldn't handle because we could not access the property, and consequently the fire started to spread through the cock loft, through across the adjoining alleys, across the street, down the block. Very predictable, but we could still not access it. We didn't have access to the Osage Avenue or its environs until somewhere around 10 o'clock in the evening.
That's the closest I've ever been to a large fire. The heat would pop the glass. You'd pop. Well, in the beginning, until that was explained or anything else, you couldn't interpret. Is that a gunshot or is it not? You don't know. So now that homes on Pine Street are starting to catch, and the move house and the house we were in is rolling, running by rolling, the fire's coming out of the windows and rolling up. I'm just thinking to myself, there's no way anybody can come out of that.
All that smoke and stuff was coming in. That's when the fire's getting heavy and all that stuff was coming in.
We heard over the 150 radio that they're coming out.
The adults were hollering out that we were coming out, we were bringing the children out.
They started hollering things and the kids coming out.
I observed a male, a tall, I thought he was tall, shirtless male come out of the, I didn't see him come out of the house, but I saw him come out of that area from the back of the move compound.
He said that Rad tried to take Tommaso out.
Mm-hmm.
How was he trying to take Tommaso out?
He opened the sink and had Tommaso was taking him out, and then he started shooting again, and then they brought him back in.
And what was he carrying?
He had a rifle on his hand.
From about how far were you from him, would you say, sir?
I would say that's approximately 75 to 100 yards in that area there.
A yard, 100 yards,
yes.
Okay. Could you observe what type of rifle it was?
Not from the seeing the rifle, all right, but from the report of the rifle.
All right. Did you then hear the report of the rifle after you saw it?
Yes.
Did you see a muzzle flash?
No.
Okay. What did you hear?
I believe it to be 4 quick shots from a 22 caliber rifle.
And the instant that we could be seen trying to come out, the cops immediately started shooting at us. You could hear the bullets hitting all around us, forcing us back into the burning building. This happened a number of times, at least twice. Started getting so bad in there with the fire spreading quickly, you know, and the smoke, that you're faced with a situation where, you know, you're either going to be burned alive or possibly shot to death. So we tried to get out again.
And then out of the smoke, the first person I saw was Ramona.
I got out. I got Birdie out. And everybody was right behind me trying to come out.
Well, I saw Ramona come over the fence. And she had started to walk down, stop. And she would wave at her hand like this. And then on the driveway, I see, who was later identified as Birdie, come out of the fire. And he literally came through the smoke and the fire. And there was a board on fire there, and he hopped over that. And he started coming down. At one time, Ramona reaches over the fence and tried to pick Birdie up, and they slipped, and they left back, and he fell backwards. And I remember he didn't get a chance to put his hands down to break his fall. Tommy Miller's right there, and Mike Tersey's right with us. Certain time he didn't get up. So I had a shotgun. I said, Tommy, here, take my shotgun. I said, I'm going to go get the kid. And at one point that I start out to get Birdie, and that's the first time I realized Officer Tersey was behind me, grabbed my left shoulder. I said, don't go out there, Jim. It's a trap. I took my Severus revolver out. That's all I had at the time. I had a 357 Magnum. And I would turn around and keep looking at Tommy.
I was right in the middle of the driveway looking down, covering both Jimmy and Officer Tersey and Birdie and Ramona.
Birdie eventually gets up. Now he's starting to walk. We're trying to say to him, son, come over here. Come over here. We're trying to get him to come to us. So I ran out, and I scooped him underneath his left arm. I'll never forget it. The first thing he said to me is, don't shoot me, don't shoot.
I was locked in on Officer Miller's face. My back's towards Moon.
I'm praying that I'm not going to see a change of expression.
And I made like a left to go out to Osage. He then started to say to me that I'm hungry. I want something to eat. I'm hungry.
That's the part I have a hard time with this kid went through. I'm hungry. After we went through all that, I'm hungry.
Officer Bergmeier, after the bomb was dropped, let's say 5:27 that afternoon, did you fire any weapon that day?
Sir, I never fired my weapon the entire day.
Officer Miller, same question to you, sir.
Also the same answer.
So for me to explain things to certain people, that's my contact. And then later on, I found out there was other kids in there. And in essence, I was a brick wall away. So it's something. Now, honestly, do I think about move every day? No. But when it's brought up, it's like it happened yesterday.
Like it, almost like it happened yesterday, you know? folks, it is like that. And certainly today gives us, again, another glimpse of not only what has happened, but what can happen. Again, those were some of the people who were directly involved 37 years ago. Of course, you heard Sister Ramona, but the young voice that you heard was the young brother known as Birdie Africa, who is now also deceased. But he was the only surviving child from 1985. And I want you to pay close attention to something that was said, that it was their intention to put a hole in some part of the building. That was an intention. And note that when it was asked, oh, by the way, one of the voices you heard was the mayor of Philadelphia at that time, that just so happened to have been the first black mayor, that all of this took place under his watch. So you heard him saying that he did not really know. He was going kind of what the police commissioner was, you know, advising him, and the city managing director. Now, remember, they follow a protocol and a chain of command. So the city managing director was really the one that the police commissioner would report to. And then, of course, the fire commissioner more or less would report to the police commissioner. Now, the city managing director, whose name was Brooks, and you probably weren't able to piece it together, so we're going to kind of do the best to help you to do that. He was the one that said that, you know, he was informed this was the best way to go and blah, blah, blah. Well, his history is that he's former military. He came out of the, the military scene before becoming the managing director. So you now had at the helm of this someone whose background was from the military. And then the person that reported to him was the police commissioner. So when you heard the police commissioner say that he did not say, let the bunker burn, it was then later discovered that somehow that got on tape somewhere and was proven that, you know, he wasn't telling the truth about that. Okay, and if you notice, the police, the fire commissioner kind of skirted around that whole issue, that he wouldn't say yes or no. He would just say that the police commissioner asked him, would it be able to be contained? And he told him he thought it could be and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, when you all, if you all get a chance and Google some of this and take a look at some of their faces, you'll kind of see that the fire commissioner was not very comfortable with what was going on. He followed the orders, but you can kind of look in his face and tell that he wasn't really feeling all of that. He went along with the program, but, you know, he had some morality, I guess you might want to call it. The rest of them people, none of that was going on. And then to hear the police person say that he didn't fire his arm, his weapon, okay, that may or may not have been true, but they ain't got nothing to do with the other people. Now, one other point that we want to point out is in 1978, immediately after the consultation that took place that initially started, you know, some of this whole thing where the city of Philadelphia under the regime of Frank Rizzo literally went into a neighborhood again and just stormed in again with fire hose of water. Now, folks to study know what this thing with water is about, because when our people were protesting and demonstrating and trying to get rights in the 1950s and 60s, what was one of the weapons they would use first? Fire hose and water. So this is a pattern that we can now see. So again, what did they do in 78? They first did it with water. When they can't get you the way they want to get you with water, then they go to the next level. So let's look again. So they then did that with 1978 with MOOG, and then again 1985. What's the next course of action? It's going to be some kind of gas, right? Now, no, as Ramona said earlier, they could have then did something. If it was about trying to, you know, have them to do something or whatever, they had other times and other means to do so. As Ramona mentioned in the earlier clip, she talked about how every day they went to the nearby park, right, for the children to be able to go to the park, you know, because that's what they were really into. Making sure that the children were able to get fresh air, to get, you know, to be able to run around, do whatever. So they were watching them all the time. So if it was about trying to deliver some warrants or whatever that they said, they certainly had ample time and ample different times to do that. So note, these are notes that the people got to pay real close attention to. Now, remember, what you also heard the fire commissioner say was at some point they realized that the fires was now going into the next block. So not only was it in the area that they initially started, the fire began to spread into other areas, right? So note, 64 homes went up in flames totally. Totally. Nothing was remaining. I mean, I want you to just imagine that, picture that if you can, in 1985, all right? And Philadelphia, not in Vietnam or not in some other country, in Philadelphia. Now, we're going to talk more about this tomorrow because a commission was put in place called the MOOG Commission to evaluate with some of what you just heard, with some of what the testimonies were as a report, as a part of the commission. So we're going to kind of revisit some of this, because one of the things that the We Charge Genocide 21 project is doing is we are reexamining documents as well as reports from 1985 and the subsequent commission that was put in place. so that people can be clear on what happened, the testimonies that were given, and, of course, the findings. This is very important. Now, also note, in this last presentation, you heard the name Tomasa. That is the one of the children that was killed in the fire, whose remains was utilized for medical research, for student research, over the past 35 years. Again, we have to show you a pattern of a certain type of behavior, that not even in death are our lives valued in such a way that it is honored and respected. Lastly, on that note, the family was finally given the remains. But again, you can imagine how traumatic to learn that your child's remains was being reviewed and looked at in order to determine what kind of outcome certain forensics or certain chemicals would do to the body, et cetera, et cetera. So family, again, today was both a day of remembrance, but also a day of examination for an atrocity that has occurred in our lifetime. Again, we have talked about what happened in Tulsa 100 years ago, but you do not hear much talk about what happened right here in Philadelphia 37 years ago, you know, considerably a shorter period of time. Why? Why did we not hear about that? And so, again, we're making certain that we bring truth, speaking truth to power, but also bringing forward some action. So before we close out tonight, family, again, we're going to ask if any of you have any comments or thoughts about some of what you heard tonight. I think we'll probably have Brother Mike on for tomorrow night, and certainly we will revisit some of what we have brought forward tonight. Chairman Fred will be joining us tomorrow night for certain. I spoke with him, so he'll definitely be calling in. But again, you know, what are your thoughts? What should we now do in regards to what has happened 37 years ago? And also, how are we prepared today? If something like this was, who would have thought that would have happened 37 years ago? Nobody thought that would happen. 64 homes just go up in total flames, a total black community destroyed, 11 people killed in a military type of format. So if they did it then, what would stop them from doing it now? And what would our responses be? So we're going to go to our lines. We have a couple of folks that have some comments. So, caller, we're going to go to 1-004. 1-004, your mic is open. Welcome to this edition of New Day.
Hi, my name is Darcy. Hello. I want to say thank you so much for educating us even more on, you know, the little bit of bits and pieces you get. It makes you want to look more and dig more. And I'm angry, you know, to be honest. I'm like furious. I'm like, I wish that we all just gather for a change. I would just love to see us unite for once and stop hurting each other and stop not educating ourselves and believing everything the stupid government say and just get together and just protect each other. Our men stand up and protect our women. I just would love to just experience that for a change, you know. So I'm angry. I'm grateful. I'm all these things, but I tell you one thing, when it goes down, I'm going to be ready. That I will say, I'm dying for the cause. I'm ready to die for it. That's what my comment. And thank you again, sister.
Oh, it's a pleasure, an honor, and a responsibility. And sister, let me just share with you, I'm feeling you, and I really appreciate your comments. And you're right, we do need to do certain things. But here's the thing that I'm proposing and working on, and that is those of us that feel a certain way, think a certain way, we've got to come together first, right? Because, you know, to think that, like, the masses or a whole lot of other people are going to do, or, you know, different things, those of us who think a certain way or similar, we've got to make the commitment with each other first. And so we need to come up with when we're going to do that, how we're going to do that, and with that, develop some codes of conduct that we all agree on, regardless of religion, regardless of social status, regardless of education, because all of that stuff is secondary. We black first. So what we have to at some point do, and hint, hint, we'll be doing some of that in September when we begin to hold what we call our first pre-plebiscite convention forums, because emancipation happened, and I said it because Juneteenth is coming, and a lot of people observe Juneteenth and do the festive part of it, but we want to now look at the work that takes us from Lincoln's emancipation to our real liberation. This is the kind of stuff we now have got to literally look at in terms of the work. You know, what work are we going to come up with that's now going to, you know, manifest what you're saying, what I'm saying, and what other people are saying. But since I thank you so much for your comment. And again, you know, all I can say is ashe. But with that said, let's come up with some tactical operations in terms of what we're going to do and how we're going to do it.
Count me in. I'm there. Count me in.
All right, sis. Well, thank you so much. And if you don't mind, I have your number. So if you don't mind, I'd like to text you periodically, you know, just keep you updated with what. Okay, cool.
Yes,
all right.
I'm always in the meetings. I get texts all the time. I'm always there. I'm always in the meetings. I don't care what you're doing. I'm always calling in or whatever I have to do. Yes, keep me in the loop or whatever I got. I mean, I try. I talk to my fellow neighbors, and, you know, we got like-minded people. It's more than one of us. I forward it to a few people. They might be on here, you know. So I try to do my little best. But, yeah, I get some more guidance. I would keep on doing it. I don't mind putting in the work. I don't mind.
I know that's right. That's what I'm talking about. All right, my sister. Well, thank you again, and have a blessed weekend.
You too. Thank you.
All right, I say. All right, family. See, that's what we're talking about. You know, again, we bring you information. What you do with it is totally up to you. We're not trying to tell anybody what to do or how to do it beyond a certain point. But if it hits you and you feeling it, then you know what time it is. And we're just here to help, you know, bring that clarity, but also connect these black dots with others who are of similar and or like mind. So again, our regular program is every Saturday night, 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We're now in our 13th straight year, straight, nonstop. Okay, so, you know, that's the type of commitment that you've got to start seeing. If you can't see consistency and commitment of a certain type, then you need to be in the position or state of mind that it is like things that make you want to go, you know, second, you need to check it out. Lastly, before we close out again, if there's any more questions or comments, you can press one now. I want to remind you that the Million Woman March 25-year anniversary is coming, and it is definitely going to set some stuff off. We are very clear now about some things that we weren't clear about before, and we are going to respond now and act accordingly. So this year's reunion is the kickoff for a year-long commemoration. We'll be coming to at least 25 cities with not only the commemoration of the largest gathering in the world of any women anywhere ever in one location, but also our plans of action. Now, again, for those who remember 97, and I'm hoping those who participated will now become alumni members to help us grow and develop in the ways that we need to economically, holistically, et cetera. But folks, remember, we did have Sister Ramona Africa speak at the Million Woman March. All right, so we're not just talking about this today. We have a history of 25 years of doing certain kinds of work. So both Sister Ramona and Sister Pam Africa spoke at the Million Woman March. to bring the information at that time about the Move 9 that were incarcerated and, of course, about Mumia Abu-Jamal. Our position hasn't changed. So, again, the consistency is there. You can also know that we read a message from Sister Asada Shakur that was given to us specifically from her. At that point, we couldn't do it like you can do now today virtually. We had to have her to, you know, send it to us in writing. But it was read at the Million Woman March in English and in Spanish. So again, the consistency of fighting for our freedom fighters, fighting for our political prisoners, et cetera, is there. Show me what Black women's organization has done that consistently for 25 years on the front line. Yes, I said it, because, you know, the nonsense has to stop. It has to stop. You know, folks get all kinds of support and, you know, and all this other stuff. But yet when we talk about the representation of our Black women, where is that at, and particularly in terms of a national, international movement? Well, that's what we're bringing forward now as a part of our 25-year anniversary. And, you know, we're going to see who steps up to support in whatever way. We hope that they do, but if they don't, that's okay too. Because y'all know about Black women. Once we make up our minds, it's a wrap. And right about now, oh, it's definitely a wrap, because our children, and we're not just talking about our biological children, as the mother of civilization, we're saying our people are now at severe risk. And so mama's got to step it up. Anyway, family, we thank you all again for tuning into this session of New Day. We have a lot of new things that we're bringing to you very soon. Again, our regular program tomorrow, 10:30 p.m., joining us, Chairman Fred Hampton Jr. He's going to give us some real exciting information and updates on several things. Of course, he just recently came from Ghana. And, of course, now the Hampton House is officially a historical site, or, you know, what they give historical recognitions, you know, different states and all of that. So that's really good in a context of really helping to secure the house. You know, his father, of course, was murdered, you know, by the police. And so, again, that's the house that his father grew up in. I was blessed to stay at the house when I went to Chicago the last time. At any rate, Kim and Fred will be joining us tomorrow. So, family, listen, please pass the word. MWM is on the move. 25 straight years of nonstop commitment and work, now bringing forth the first global movement for women and girls of African descent. And brothers, we have a component for you, brothers in support, our brotherhood. I'll tell you more about that tomorrow. At any rate, sisters, please support. We have like 25 new memberships, okay, because, again, we don't do the grants. We don't do the corporate sponsoring. All right, so again, on a national level, show me what Black women's organization that you can say does that in terms of representing self-determination. So again, tune in tomorrow. We'll be giving you more information on today's activities, as well as, you know, what's going on with some other things in terms of Mumia. And, hey, just tune in. So we thank you all again, and, you know, talk to you tomorrow. Remember, there will never really be any peace until there's truly justice. Because for real, if there's no justice, there will be no peace. So tomorrow, Chutanana. Thank you.